Accession number 3901, reel 5.
After working on several documentaries, and just about earning a living, I was called to ACT's head office by George Elvin, and I met another film technician, a chap called Roy Stocks, who was an editor, and he sent us along to the War Office to see a Major Horton, who was something to do with public relations, and I always remember Horton. He eventually became known as Papa Horton, because, you know, he was a very dear man, very nice man. And he explained both to Roy Stocks and myself that as soon as we were called up, once we had our interview, we were to tell the interviewing officer that we were wanted by the War Office to be film technicians, and that was the end of that kind of interview. And we were both rather impressed by this rather nice major who was very unmilitary in his approach to us. He treated us very much as friends.
Did he know anything about filming?
I don't think he did. I assume that he was a regular army. He was in the War Office. I suppose he would. I wouldn't know what his age would be. Difficult to age a person from this kind of distance in time. About a fortnight later, I was summoned for a medical up at Finchley, and I had my medical, and I said my little piece to the interviewing officer, who just said, "Absolute rubbish, the army does not want photographers." And that was the end of that conversation. I was then, got my, as it were, posting, or my call-up papers to join the chemical warfare training battalion down at Barton Stacey. This was in September.
September 1940.
September 1940. And, I started on basic training down there. And by the end of October, I'd done something to my knee. I'd what they call an IDK, an internal rupture of the knee or something, and I went into a hospital at Park Pruitt, which was the old Hampshire lunatic asylum, which had been cleared of its inmates, now become a base hospital. That's where I met my wife. I was there. I had surgical treatment, and I came out just after Christmas, was on sick leave, and I thought seriously about this, and I rang up the War Office and in fear and trepidation, and spoke to Major Horton, who told me to go and see him. So I went and saw him, and he was, again, very kind to me. He said I wasn't to worry. He took the address of the unit to which I was being posted on my return from sick leave, and he said, when you arrive at the unit, the CO will see you. He sees everybody after they come back from sick leave, and you're to tell him he's to hold you until you're called. You tell him that the wheels are in motion. So I returned to Barton Stacey into the holding company. I saw the CO, and I told him what Papa Horton had told me. And he gave instructions to the CSM that I wasn't to be posted, I was to be held awaiting further instructions, which arrived, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks later. And I was posted to public relations in Cadogan Square. I arrived there and I saw Staff Sergeant Billett. The CSM was Danny Flood, and Colonel McCormack was in charge of the public relations unit. I think that the Army Film Unit, or whatever it was called, or Public Relations Film Unit, was attached to the PR purely for administrative purposes like pay and billets. They had no hand at all in giving us instructions. Our instructions came from David MacDonald, who was the CO of the unit. It was a very small unit. But at this particular time when I joined, I think I joined on the same day or the day after Alfred Black. There was Gerald Keane, who was a sergeant or a staff sergeant, David MacDonald, Walter Dane Court, Harry Rignold, I think Jerry Massey Collier had already gone out to the Far East, to the Middle East, so he wasn't there. And a few weeks, or the odd month afterwards, Hugh Stewart arrived, Bob Verrill, and I think a little while after him, Bob Carrick.
What contact did you have with David MacDonald?
Well, the very first contact we had with David MacDonald was, I think, Alf Black and I were in what was our kind of equipment room at Cadogan Square. And Dave walked in one morning and he said, "Good morning, men." Both Alf and I kind of looked over our shoulders to see how many other men there were behind us. And I think we both said, "Oh, good morning, Dave." And he never repeated that one again on us. However, he went about with us quite a bit. I think really to get a feeling of what really was going on. We did coverage of the Blitz.
Did he issue instructions?
No, not really. No, not really. The big Blitz of London was already over, and I think Walter Dane Court and Harry Rignold had done more coverage than anybody else, and a lot of the coverage which is credited to the newsreels in fact is Walter Dane Court's coverage and Harry Rignold's. But I can remember we went round filming ACAC batteries at work at night and also during the daytime. And in fact, I can remember, almost wanting to kind of nip home for a cup of tea, as it were, because we were on the Heath extension, which had been turned into an enormous battery. We filmed all kinds of things. Dave would always be there, but he didn't give us instructions because, in fact, what we were doing, I suppose, would be offered to the newsreels.
Was your brief specifically to cover events of a military nature, or were civilian?
Well, I think it was all of a military nature, really. Any impingement of, if you like, of civilians would be only in passing. At that particular time, I think, because I think there'd been a surfeit of the Blitz material, and after the fires over London, which you can't keep on doing it because it becomes passé in a way. This is a dreadful thing.
Did you find difficulty finding stories?
Well, you see, at this time there was nothing really going on. Apart from the Western Desert, There was nothing going on that was really filmable, although we filmed all kinds of mad inventions. I can remember going down to, I think it was Shrewbinesse with Dave MacDonald, and seeing various kind of anti-tank devices. There was a ditch, somebody fired a very light pistol at it, and up it went in flames. Well, you can imagine kind of digging ditches all around England with full of water with oil on, and people were waiting with very light to fire at them. And there were mad things, and there was the same kind of demonstration. This was put on by petroleum warfare, again a branch of the engineers. And this was firing a great drum at a tank, and the drum hit the tank and it kind of exploded and covered it in flames, I suppose. The early napalm bomb, I suppose.
Were you ever short of film?
No, we were never short of film. Our shortage was equipment, and we were. One of the jobs I got involved in actually was kind of going round, either commandeering or persuading people to sell their equipment to the unit. And of course, the last thing in the world one wanted to do was to commandeer equipment, if one could possibly avoid it, because after all, we were living on the goodwill of the industry, really, because our repairs were done for us. Kind of money was tight, I think, as far as the unit was concerned, for repairs and things like that. We were expected to kind of repair equipment ourselves. At least I imagine that was the intention. Well, repairing cine equipment is a very a technical job, and we relied on the goodwill of people like George Hill at the Bush. And so the last thing in the world one would want to do would be to commandeer his equipment. I think we talked to George Hill, and you know, we perhaps got some of the equipment he didn't want. You see, our basic camera in those days was a Newman Sinclair. This was known as the by documentary boys, anyway, as the kind of the Rolls Royce of light equipment. They weren't mass produced. They were made to order. They were all made by hand, and they were hard to come by.
Will you describe the Newman Sinclair?
It was made of aluminium sheet. It's a cube. It had a magazine which had a 200-foot run. The magazine, as I say, it was 200-foot run. That was made by hand. It didn't have a turret. Each lens was mounted on a panel, and you had a not a particularly good viewfinder system. However, as you were probably a Newman addict, you knew how to work your viewfinder without problems.
What was the problem?
Well, parallax, because it was using a Newtonian finder. Not, you weren't looking through the lens at all. You could some of the models you could look through the lens, but as you were looking through the base of the film as well, and that was a grey back, it was a very dim image. But however, as I say, you know, they were a very fine camera.
What was your rank when you joined the Army Film Unit in Pembury?
Well, I came up from Barton Stacey as a sapper, and then the next day at Cadogan Square I became a sergeant, and then in the September I was commissioned, became a lieutenant. I suppose they needed some more chiefs to go to look after the Indians. That's the only thing I assume.
Did your work change?
Not at all. No, no. I mean, you know, I was a technician, and I remained a technician right the way through, really.
One of your tasks was to view films sent back from the various theatres.
That's right. We used to have these great viewing sessions at the War Office when material was on offer to the newsreels and things like that. And I would write technical criticism and content criticism because, after all said and done, none of these chaps out in the field ever saw their material, unless, of course, they were lucky enough to come back to England. And this very rarely happened, and even then there wouldn't be the time available to show them their material. And so one tried, you know, to be in the chap's shoes and kind of help him along so he knew, you know, if he'd succeeded or where he'd failed.
You were responsible for the First Army Film Unit training course.
Yes, that's so. It was around about the end of 1941, beginning of perhaps 42, I'm not quite sure which. We were based on Curzon Street House. The soldiers on the course were living at Marylebone Transit Camp. I had Bill Allen, who was a sergeant, to help me. We gave lectures, we gave demonstrations, and I think after a period, the course was divided into two. We gave a basic training and basic instruction, and kind of halfway through we did an examination, for want of a better word, so that we made sure that at least, you know, they had picked up basic knowledge and they really did know what we were talking about. Well, this did a little bit of weeding out, and it sorted one or two of them out who were RTD'd. And then from there, we then started using film, and we used to go up to the Heath Extension to film. Put on very small mock battles, and the film would be viewed the next day, and I would criticise, or Bill Allen would criticise and show people where they went wrong. And the end of that course, those who'd passed it, I assumed would be going to go into the film unit. That was ultimately, of course, to go to North Africa. We didn't know at the time that's where they were going. The commanding officer of that film unit was Hugh Stewart, and he, together with, I think, Alf Black, Nelson Keyes, and one or two others, I think, interviewed and turned down some of the people whom I'd passed, and this made me, of course, particularly cross, because I'd worked with these lads, and I knew the ones who were, at least I believe I knew the ones who were going to make good cameramen, but they were turned down on a 2-minute interview, which was I think rather unfortunate and rather unfair.
You contested this, didn't you?
Well, it was very difficult to contest it. I made my opinion known, and I suppose I made myself rather unpopular, certainly with Hugh Stewart. He wasn't at all pleased that I should interfere with his selection of what was going to be his unit. But I felt that I had to speak. I did.
Were you surprised then when you weren't placed in charge of the second training course?
No, not at all, because I suppose, if you like, I felt if this is the way they were going to choose their unit, they better, you know, find somebody else to train them, because I didn't want to get involved. And if you like, in a way, one gets a personal involvement. I mean, if you feel that somebody is giving of their best, and it is a best, they should at least expect some recognition for it. But this was not the case.
What cameras did you use during the training?
Well, I think this time we were using the DeVry, because this was going to be the basic equipment for this unit that was being built up. The Ministry of Supply had, asked Newman Sinclair's to kind of go into mass production, but this had presented enormous problems to Newman's. They couldn't get sufficient skilled technicians to make cameras in bulk. They weren't available. And making a film camera is a precision job. So one had to look at other sources of supply. The DeVry in the States was a camera used by amateurs who wanted to work with 35mm film. It was a very poor camera. It had a 100-foot spool. It was bashed out tin, no more than that. There were IMOs in the States, but again, at that particular time, they weren't mass-produced. They started mass-producing them, and we certainly started getting supplies of IMOs later. But again, in the typical fashion on this leaseland, before the war, one tended to get the rejected American equipment. I mean, I can remember we had one IMO which arrived, and the lens barrels, or the lens mounts were oval. They weren't round, and this had to be completely re-sleeved, and so you had a non-standard camera. One was appalled by some of the standard of equipment that we did get, but by the time the IMOs were arriving, we were then coming up to D-Day, and again, along with that, there was insufficient, and Vintons were then called upon to produce a British battle camera, and they embarked again upon a bashed out piece of, well, it wasn't tin, it was not aluminium, but one of the alloys, and they made what became known as the Normandy. Now, this was a 200-foot spool camera. It again presented enormous problems because it was spring driven, and to get good springs in wartime was rather like asking for the moon. And we'd get broken springs galore. You get springs which would get tired very quickly, very soft. We had gates that would be buckling. This business of having masses of cameramen with masses of equipment is easily thought of, but very difficult to achieve. And, it did present us with a lot of problems. I was involved in testing equipment and accepting equipment. I was involved with the Newmans when they started to try and mass produce those. I was involved with the Vintons when they were mass producing those, seeing all the tests. Every camera was tested. Every single camera was tested. And I saw all the tests, with the manufacturer's representative. I was also involved in the acceptance and testing of the tripods, which were made by Jelks in Holloway Road. I think they made billiard tables or something at some time or other. And again, some of these were quite frightful. The equipment they churned out, and the rejection rate of tripods was enormous. quite in awe. Frightening, in fact. In a way, I was. This was a great worry to me because, you know, I mean, these people at Vinton's, whom I'd known for many years before the war, I used to get very upset. I get very angry with them, and not wishing to lose my temper because, you know, they were my old friends. One had very divided loyalties on this. I was very glad when I didn't do it anymore. When I went out to Burma, I was very glad to get rid of that.